This is episode 486. There seems to be an explosion of ADHD cases to the point that it feels like everyone has it, and maybe unsurprisingly, the medication is nowhere near the silver bullet cure that it was once promoted as being. And so on this episode, I talk with a psychologist that specializes in ADHD, learning disabilities, and cognitive decline about just where this ADHD explosion has come from. Is it the gentle parenting methods that lack strong boundaries, structure, and direction? Is it the brain jacked up on a life of sugar that degrades our neurons? Is it the screen addiction? Is it the trauma? Where is it coming from? This conversation bounces around a bit due to the popcorn-styled nature of my own brain. So if you have a child with ADHD or you as an adult are looking for, you know, natural or holistic ways to manage or reverse your own diagnosis, then this episode is for you. So let's get into it. Even as a scientist and nutritionist, I was secretly trapped in binge eating and hooked on sugar. And let's be real, the so-called solutions can feel overwhelming. Calorie counting, restrictive diets, weight loss pills, surgery, and even injections. I'm Maddie Lansdowne, and the truth is, more nutrition facts aren't the answer. It's understanding why we eat the way we do. And you don't need to be perfect to achieve great health either. That shift changed everything for me, and now I share it here as the host of the Real Weight Loss Coach podcast, where it's my mission to help 1 million people break free from the yo-yo diet cycle for good by bringing you the conversations that really matter in nutrition, health, and psychology. And I'm not afraid to challenge mainstream health advice when it doesn't stack up. Are you ready? Let's begin. What's up, my healthy friends? Welcome back to another episode where we do our best to dig deeper than generic wellness questions and advice that you hear on other podcasts. Also here this year, it's my mission to support 500 people to achieve real weight loss. And by real, I mean dealing with what's really weighing you down and not just the number on your scale. The link to book a discovery call is down in the show notes or the caption down below. So, moving on to today's episode, we have a return guest, Dr. Amy Moore, first appearing on episode 227. She's a cognitive psychologist who runs research at Learning RX, which is the largest network of brain training centers on the planet. She's also an ADHD expert and has spent 30 years figuring out why kids struggle when there's technically nothing wrong with them. She's also a TEDx speaker, podcast host, and someone who challenges conventional thinking in the education and brain training space, which is right at home here on this podcast. We challenge a lot of narratives in the health space. So, Amy, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Maddie. Excited to be back.
I'm excited to have you back. And I love that I've just discovered that you've got 3 adult sons and having, you know, just experienced a son come into my life. Like I said before, you're going to be the oracle in my life that I'm going to hit up and for all the parenting advice.
Awesome. Happy to give you as much advice as you feel like taking or not.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm going to take it all and then sift through it.
Okay, sounds good.
So speaking about kids and parenting and therefore adults, you've got adult children now. You've been working with, I guess, people with challenges with their mental state, their mental health, ADHD, that kind of stuff. You've got kids that have experienced ADHD and you yourself as well. And so I imagine there was this moment, I guess, of this clash of information of like professional textbook knowledge and then practical working reality. And so I'm curious to know what happened in that space as you started learning and started working in your own life with the comparison between your lived experience and the textbook of what you know about ADHD.
Yeah, so I think that we have this propensity for dichotomous thinking sometimes. And, you know, I was diagnosed in my late teens or maybe 20-ish. And, okay, you have ADHD, here's your Ritalin. And I thought, okay, great, here's my Ritalin. And then as I began working with children, okay, where's your Ritalin? Right. And so it was this, okay, you have ADHD, you take Ritalin, you have ADHD, you take Ritalin. And while, right, I saw improvements and because I was in college, right? So I saw improvements. I didn't look at anything else about it, right? Here's your diagnosis. Here's your treatment. Now move on with the rest of your life. And so it wasn't until I started working with parents who didn't want to put their children on Ritalin. Mm-hmm. And at first, you know, I had this initial visceral response. Well, if your child was diabetic, wouldn't you put them on insulin, right? Like, it didn't make any sense to me. If your child has a broken leg, wouldn't you put a cast on it? Mm. And so, again, this dichotomous thinking and almost judgmental thinking, and this is in the late 90s or mid to late 90s, early 2000s. And so the more and more and more I worked with families who struggled to want to put their kids on medication or had put their kids on medication, but the side effects were debilitating, right? We'd have children falling asleep at the lunch table at school, right? Because they were over-medicated. And there were still symptoms that weren't addressed by the Ritalin, right? That I began to say, okay, what are we missing? What do we still need to be looking at? And fortunately, that sort of converged on the rise of functional medicine and the more holistic mental health that we started seeing the trend in the late 2000s, you know, pushing 2010. And so that's when I started saying, okay, there has to be more than medication because medication doesn't seem to be the silver bullet that we thought it was in 1987. And so I think that's where it converged that, look, I want to be respectful of families' wishes. I want to be fully present for the struggle, right? Mm-hmm. That kids are having, that families are having. And then my oldest not only had ADHD, but had Tourette syndrome. And he couldn't take a central nervous system stimulant because it mm-hmm. made the tics worse. So now I was in this space of saying, my kid has ADHD and I can't give him a central nervous system stimulant. Now what? And so I think at that point, that's when it all converged, right? That, okay, I need to look at this more holistically, see what the research out there is saying about the ADHD brain. What do we know about it? Look at neuroimaging results, you know, look at neurotransmitters and like, let's look at all of those influences and see if there's a way that we can hit it from other angles.
Yeah, it's so nice to hear when anybody talks on this show or in any context about the realization that, yeah, medication is very rarely the silver bullet we once hoped it was going to be. And, you know, there's all sorts of rabbit holes to go down about big pharma and, you know, medical education and all that kind of stuff. But I like that functional medicine and holistic medicine is coming into these spaces. And so I guess the sort of natural question that's second to what you've just shared is like, what are those other things that need to be factored in situations where people, one, can't take the medication, or two, the medication isn't seemingly that effective?
Yeah, I love this question. It's one of my favorite questions. And I actually travel around to conferences answering this question. It's become a platform for me because mm-hmm. I want families to know that we need to look at our lifestyles and our life choices. And once we've tried all of these other things, then we can look at medication, right? Like I always say, and I'll talk about them in a sec. I always say that, you know, we can kill a fly on a wall with a wrecking ball or a fly swatter and both do the job, right? Yeah. But one of them does a little bit of damage to the wall. And so I sort of equate that with side effects, right? We are not going to have side effects from optimizing our sleep. Right? We're not going to have side effects from looking long and hard about what we're putting in our bodies, right? Like, So that's
why positive side effects will happen instead.
Well, right? Right? Like these benefits, they're like, wow, this is crazy. But that's the first thing I ask about, you know, when I have a family that says, I think my child has ADHD or my child was diagnosed about ADHD. And I say, how's his sleep? How's her sleep? Because we know that kids with ADHD struggle with sleep. But sleep is like putting our brains through a car wash. So like as we go about our day, we use up neurotransmitters and those neurotransmitters, you know, leave behind toxins that's the best way to say it. And so then when we fall asleep, our brain shrinks just a tiny bit and we get this big whoosh of cerebrospinal fluid that literally cleanses our brains at the end of the day from these toxins. Well, if we have toxins building up in our brains, that makes it really hard for our neurons to communicate effectively. Mm-hmm. And the ADHD brain already struggles with neuronal communication. So why make it harder? And so if we can give our brains a fresh start every morning by optimizing sleep in the evenings, then that's an amazing place to start.
After 4 months of baby life, I don't think my brain's been washed in a while.
Yeah. Yeah. But I know you and your work. And so you are optimizing these other areas of your life so that at least you're giving yourself a fighting chance.
Yeah. Well, and to be totally honest, like he's a pretty good sleeper. So like last night, I think I got 6 hours straight before he woke up, like, which is not uncommon. So pretty lucky.
Yeah. Yeah. That's awesome.
Something that I just thought of as you were saying, like you were asking people about sleep and families, about what the environment is like and what's the food like and stuff like that. That leads me to think or ask the question about causes for ADHD. Because one thing that seems to be consistent in what I'm seeing, researching, looking into, even just anecdotally talking to people about, is the environment and particularly screens are like exacerbators or causes or contributors to an ADHD brain or personality traits or types. So is there anything that falls into that sort of lifestyle holistic bucket of things that would be part of the solution, which actually might, looking at the other direction, might be part of the cause?
Yeah. So, you know, ADHD, it has diverse etiology. And so what that means is there is not one singular cause of ADHD. It's a collection of symptoms that when combined, we can say, yes, this looks like ADHD. Mm-hmm. There's not a widely accepted blood test biomarker, right, for mm-hmm. ADHD. So I would not land on the idea that screens cause ADHD. I would not mm-hmm. land on that. Would I say that it could exacerbate symptoms for some kids? Absolutely. And as we know, most kids with ADHD and adults have this ability to hyperfocus on things that they enjoy. And we know that the algorithms are on social media are designed to hit dopamine again and again and again and again. And we know that dopamine is implicated in ADHD. So a steady stream of it, a steady source of dopamine, is going to be appealing to the ADHD mm-hmm. brain. And so then what happens is you have a harder time being sensitive to lesser stimulus, things mm-hmm. that don't create the same level of dopamine hit that a social media algorithm can do. So then can that appear to worsen some symptoms like decreased motivation in a brain that already struggles with motivation? Yes, for sure. But I'm not anti-screen either. Oh, and then back to sleep, right? Like we know that excessive blue light in the evening is going to delay the release of melatonin. Mm-hmm. We're already struggling with sleep and ADHD. And so now you're going to bed even later because you've been on screens too late in the day. So then that's a cycle of just chasing your tail on, you know, sleep deprivation. Then your brain can't be cleansed from the cerebrospinal fluid that's released during sleep. So then your neurons can't communicate as effectively. So then the rest of your symptoms are exacerbated. So I don't think it's a direct cause. I think it's a byproduct, right? Like it's somewhere in the upline. When this happens, then this happens, then this happens, then this happens. So then back to my original comment, I am not in the camp that shouts, oh, screen's bad. I'm just not. So connection is the number one buffer against mental health crisis. When we take screens away, like so when we take phones away from our teenage child because they're spending too much time on their phone, we're severing critical connections that those teens need. Because we know that friendships are typically stronger relationships than, you know, parent-teen relationships many times. And so taking that away, I think, exacerbates the mental health struggle. So I think that we need to look at, okay, where can we place some limits? Where can we talk about some healthy use of screens and healthy use and limits on social media? But again, it should not be dichotomous thinking, right? Mm. It's not all or nothing here, right? There has to be a way that kids can still have connection and access to the internet to do their homework. And, oh, a little bit of entertainment is okay too. But how do we do that in a healthy way, in an appropriate way, and in a way that doesn't make our symptoms worse?
The thing that I feel challenged by with that is that these are, as you talked about, like these are dopamine producing, and whether it be video games or Facebook or, you know, a Netflix series, there's an algorithm behind it that is designed to create some kind of addictive behavior within us. And so the idea of, you know, it feels like a great intention to be safe and effective, you know, that sort of throwaway line that medicine likes to use on things. Oh, but it's safe and effective. Let's use this addictive drug in a safe and effective way. Like, and so it's like, how do we create boundaries and restrictions and things around screens, games, these things? Because you see, like, as you probably know, but parents deal with kids losing their mind when they take screens off them. Like, I'm a part of all these parenting channels now, trying to become the expert on that, which obviously it's probably impossible to do, but just trying to learn all these things. And the amount of videos that I see of these kids that get screens taken off them, or these kids that are numb because they're given a screen as a solution to their tantrum or to just shut them up for a while. It just makes me wonder, because it's like, because a lot of parents are addicted. A lot of us are addicted to screens as well. So how is it possible to create like a safe environment for screens when everybody's addicted to the same drug? And the same conversation could be said for sugar, right?
Yeah. Let's talk about that in a minute too. Put a pin in that, because I want to come back to it. Yeah. Yeah. So parenting starts with us, right? Parenting is not childing. Parenting is parenting. So we have to be super intentional about our parenting decisions. And it starts with knowing what our parenting values are, and then making every decision through that lens. And so most of us are not going to say one of our parenting values is screen use, right? And so, but what is a parenting value? That we want our children to have happy, healthy, connected relationships with people they care about? Yes. So then when making a decision about whether or not to limit screen time or take phones away, we say, okay, does that move us towards our parenting value of having happy, healthy, connected relationships with people they care about, or does it move it away from that value? And so if we sever that connection, right, that moves us away from that value. So then we have to say, okay, well, then how can we nurture that parenting value in some other way? So I'm kind of digressing a little bit, but the point is that every decision that we make has to be intentional. And so we have to be able to build relational equity with our kids in as many places as we can, so that when we do need to set a firm limit, we have that relational equity. We have a relationship where a kid goes, okay, I'm going to trust my mom in this moment or my dad in this moment because I know, because of experience, again and again and again, that they love me, that they care about me, that they want the best for me, and that they know best in this moment. And they give me power and control when they can. They allow me to make choices where they can, right? And so when they do have to say a firm, this is what the boundary is, this is what the limit is, I'm going to be okay with that. Or I'm going to ask questions. And my parents have created this environment where questions are okay. Why, mom? Why do I have to get off of it? Well, because let me talk to you about how the brain works. Let me share with you about your brain, right? Like, so the ADHD brain works a little bit differently. So I want to talk to you about this. So as parents, we get to do some psychoeducation there too. But none of that can happen if we aren't having these open, honest, loving, power exchanging relationships with our child from day one, right? Because a lot of us parent like we were parented, and those of us were parented in a way where our parents were, because I'm the dad, I said so, right? Then we come into parenting thinking, oh, that's how you're supposed to parent. So then I have people on my couch saying, my kid won't listen to me. Well, talk to me about your relationship. Well, they need to mind me or behave me because I said so. Okay, well, how's that working? That's my favorite question to ask. How's that working for you? I guarantee you, if that were working for you, you wouldn't be sitting in front of me right now asking for help. So we just have to be intentional in as many areas as we can, so that when we do need to set a limit, we don't have as much conflict and pushback. Mm-hmm. And then we have to take a long, hard look at our own behaviors too, right? So what are we modeling? And if we are addicted to screens, we have to say, what is it that's missing in our lives that we're only think that we think we can only get from the screen, right? So I need to find other ways to get healthy dopamine, right? Or I need to sit arm to arm with my partner and release some oxytocin, right? So that I get some feel good hormone.
Yeah.
While we read a book together.
Yeah, yeah. I've got a few things I want to say, but before I do that, let's go to the sugar piece as well.
Yeah. Okay. So after I talk about sleep, I'm going to talk about what we're putting in our bodies, right? Because there are some large and growing bodies of research on nutrition and ADHD. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, sugar has been one of those controversial topics since the 80s, where we said, oh, well, sugar makes kids hyperactive, therefore we should not give kids sugar. And so there was some research that came out that did not show an association. And so the people who were not in the sugar camp ran with that.
Yeah.
Well, if we continue to watch the research, there has been more research again and again and again that has said there is an association between the amount of sugar and the amount of hyperactive behavior. We know that sugar is inflammatory, right? And so if the body's inflamed, so is the brain. We have inflammation in our brain, neuronal connection is difficult. And that alone should tell us something, right? Like, even though we have this body of research that is showing this connection between sugar and exacerbated ADHD symptoms, but the mere fact that we are inflaming our brains, like, let's not make it harder for our child's brain to work.
Yeah. And I mean, I remember as a kid, you know, you knew if somebody had red cordial or red soft drink or soda, you know, it was common conversation between parents to be like, no, this particular kid can't have that because they end up going crazy and berserk, even if they don't have ADHD. And so, yeah, it feels like one of those things that there's 10 million anecdotes, but still scientific research hasn't really caught up in the right way. And what I mean is that, you know, people leverage that particular study or that particular chapter.
Well, sure.
Chapter.
It's the confirmation bias, right?
Yeah, completely. Yeah. Completely. Yeah.
Well, but 87% of studies since 1990 show an association between artificial food dyes and ADHD symptoms. 87%.
Wow, that's very high.
So those are not randomized controlled trials because that would not be ethical, right? Like, let's not put a group of kids and give them all artificial food dyes and measure their ADHD symptoms and commit, right? Like I would scream, okay, we've got an ethical issue here among these researchers. However, when you have study after study after study after study showing the same association, something is happening.
Mm. Yeah, I totally agree. And I think plenty of parents would agree. And equally, adults that have looked into health at all that start to self-observe, like, oh, how do I feel after sugar? Or how do I feel after these types of foods? But the thing that I wanted to get into, and I've been looking for a window into this conversation that we had before we hit record, but I think I've found it, which is like this conversation about sort of modeling, you know, having parenting values that you're able to live by so that your child can look up and be like, oh, that's how we do things, or that's how my parents do things, is that you were talking to me before about the percentage of people nowadays that are estranged from their parents. And we were talking about how modern psychology or modern personal development has led to this kind of strange crisis of people, you know, cutting ties with family, cutting ties with quote unquote toxic people, and being even less resilient than they were before after going through all of this personal development. And so I wonder, with this big move for gentle parenting and not being a dominating parent, or not being a parent that's super in control and giving your child a voice in the conversation, how do we, like, it's, I'm not really parenting yet because I'm just, you know, in the phase of keeping a child alive.
Yeah, you're surviving.
Yeah, exactly. It's not really parenting, but I'm trying to expose myself to a lot of these ideas. And it feels like there's this real wrestle between gentle parenting and treating the child like an equal member of the house and has a voice and has a contribution and they matter. But at the same time, I'm over here as the man of the house thinking I want to create a boy that grows into a resilient man that can handle pressure and stress, and at the same risk of being like, if I'm too hard and fast and direct and controlling or whatever, or authoritative, he might be estranged from me because He has 4,000 people that he follows on social media that say, your dad's toxic, you know, because he grounded you for a week, whatever it might be. So, I feel like this is a confusing space of like modeling good parenting, but not giving in to addictive things like sugar. And because my kid wants it and the kid grows up to think, oh, you know, my dad wouldn't let me have any good things. So the second I left home, I rebelled and destroyed my life with sugar and screens. So where is this? I mean, I know there's not a definitive answer, but it feels like it's a tricky space to exist right now for gentle parenting instead of, you know, more hard and fast rules and structure. And there's a consequence in either system, it seems. Loving what you're hearing? Make sure you're subscribed here on your favorite podcast app. Or there's even more waiting for you over on YouTube. On our channel, you'll get to see our fascinating guests demonstrate their techniques in real time. You'll see my animated explanation of complex health concepts made simple, plus all of those you had to be there moments that we mentioned in the show. The Coaching with Maddie episodes will be there too. We're also creating exclusive YouTube shorts, quick, powerful health tips you won't find anywhere else. And let's face it, if we're going to be doom scrolling, which we all do from time to time, you might as well make it worthwhile. Just search How to Not Get Sick and Die podcast on YouTube and hit subscribe to unlock the visual side of becoming a healthy friend of the show. Because sometimes you need to see it to believe it and also to achieve it. The direct link is in the show notes below. Come and join our YouTube community.
Yeah, and there is. And there's not one. So I used to say if there were a perfect way to parent, we'd have no one in prison.
It's a good way to summarize it.
Right, like everyone would turn out perfectly. And that's just not the case. So, well, all right. First of all, kids need limits. To not give a child a limit is to put them on a tightrope without a net underneath. That is terrifying to a child, and they actually want some sort of net, right? They want to know that mom and dad are going to keep them safe, mm-hmm. right? So to not have limits sends the message that my parents aren't concerned about what happens to me. And so I think that some of the parenting choices where we choose not to set any limits, where it's an anything goes sort of environment, I don't want my child to be upset, so I'm going to let them do whatever they want, is actually creating that type of scenario. You're putting your child on a tightrope without a net because you're letting them do whatever they want. And that sends them the message that, where are my parents when I need them to help me make this decision? Mm-hmm. When I need them to redirect me, when I'm making a decision that might not be in my best interest. But it's delicate, right? Because we have to do it in a way that says, hey, I noticed that this happened when you made that decision. Let's talk about that and see if there's a way that you might be able to make a different choice next time and not suffer that type of fallout, right? Mm. So it's constantly teaching problem solving and having an open dialogue. And oh, by the way, it is my job as a parent to keep you safe. And there are going to be some things that aren't negotiable. And so, but then it's making sure that you're building relational equity all the rest of the time on those things that are negotiable, so that when you have to pull the, this is a non-negotiable card out, it lands okay. It lands better. And are there going to be kids that still push back? Absolutely. But then it becomes, okay, let's dialogue some more about it. Mm-hmm. I think that, well, the word discipline comes from the word disciple, which means to teach, not to punish.
Right.
So I never grounded my kids, but we had a lot of conversations. Right? How do we need to do this differently next time? Because most things are a learning situation, right? Not a consequence situation. And consequences just make your child upset and mad and they separate them from you. And whereas, you know, let's teach some alternatives and some options. But on that same note, we all need boundaries in every relationship that we have. We don't let our partner walk all over us. Well, not in a healthy relationship, at least. we set boundaries around our bodies and our time and our health and what we want from our lives too, right? And boundaries strengthen relationships. And even though it doesn't seem like it would, they do. So read all of Cloud Townsend's work on boundaries and your relationships get healthier. So we need to set boundaries for our kids, because then that's how they grow up to be adults who know how to reason.
Yeah, I like that. It's funny, Yali and I were having a conversation last night because I think Gabriel was upset and I made a joke of like, I was just being humorous and said something like, if you don't stop crying, you're grounded. And that started a conversation with Yali, and she goes, oh, I was never grounded growing up. What's that like? And I sort of told her a little bit and I said, why weren't you grounded? And Yali is Sri Lankan. And she said, nobody grounds anyone in Sri Lankan culture. You just live in perpetual fear. You never do anything wrong because you are terrified of your parents and the social consequences that come of shaming the family or doing something embarrassing. And she's like, yeah, Sri Lankan and Indian kids, like, we're always good. Or we move to another country and we enjoy the lives that we wish we'd had.
Yeah. So that is not what I teach.
That's not what we'll be doing either.
Right. I think it's super important that we teach our kids to make decisions because it's the right thing to do and not because they fear us. Right. And so, but again, that takes open dialogue. That takes a lot of communication. And I will tell you, dialoguing and communicating takes a little bit extra time, right? It's super easy to just impose a consequence and send our kid to their room. That's the easy way out. Really? Yeah. I mean, really, it eats into our free time when we have to take the time to dialogue, to take the time to help our kids understand why something might not have worked, to ask them, why do you think that didn't work? Mm-hmm. And what are some ways that you might be able to do it differently the next time? So Dr. Ross Green is a child psychologist who wrote the book, The Explosive Child, back in the 80s. And he's done revisions of it ever since then. But I loved his original book because it fundamentally changed the way that we parented when we were young parents. But basically, he says children do well when they can. And so when a child does something that is not what we want them to do, we have to ask ourselves, do they have the skill to do that? Right? Have we taught them the skill to do that? And do our expectations match their skills? Right? Again, parenting starts with us. I'll give you a super quick example. When my middle child was about 8, I walked into the living room to find him watching one of those, you know, painting instruction shows, like the old Bob Ross type thing. And he had spread out papers all over the coffee table. And he was drawing along with this screen. And I noticed he was using a Sharpie, and the Sharpie marker had soaked through the paper all over my wooden coffee table. Because Sharpies are not our friend, right? There's not. And I lost my mind. Like, what were you thinking? Oh my gosh, you've just ruined my table. I mean, I threw a temper tantrum at my 8-year-old child.
Yeah.
And I'm yelling and screaming. And like, all I can think about is the fact that he has destroyed this coffee table with this Sharpie, not thinking about this beautiful activity that he was participating in, right? Yeah. Like this really creative activity that was great for his brain. And he said something like, you care more about your stupid coffee table than you care about me. And I was gutted, like gutted. And as I reflected, I had to do some repair work, obviously, with my child. But as I reflected on the situation, what could I have done differently? Well, it's my responsibility to teach my child that a Sharpie soaks through paper. It's my responsibility to say, hey, when you're doing an art project, you need to put a placemat or a tablecloth or plastic down underneath so that the art materials don't ruin the furniture. That's my job, right? My 8-year-old should not be expected to think through all of the barriers to success in this art project if it is not a conversation we have ever had before, right? That was on me. And so I can't punish my child for something that I never taught him. I think that's really important as parents. for us to reflect on. Does my child have the skills to know what to do in this situation?
Yeah, that makes plenty of sense to me. And, you know, I'm hoping that I have as few crazy outbursts as possible, knowing that they will happen. They will happen. And I'll default to probably my own parents' methods at different times. But the thing that I'm curious about, and I've got multiple prongs to this question, but is I had a conversation the other day where I was talking about shame, right? The experience of shame. And I think it's Brené Brown that said shame should be abolished. It shouldn't exist. And I actually disagree with that. And I'll bring that around to this conversation, is that shame serves an important social function for accountability, right? Because using your prison example, if nobody felt any shame or remorse or disappointment in themselves, there would be no inclination to do better, right? And so I'm wondering, when it comes to navigating kids, whether they have learning difficulties or not, or whatever it might be, is there no element of shame or disappointment, or I've let my parents down, or I'm fearful of the consequences? Because if we're also not fearful of the consequences of the police or losing our job, then we also might make decisions that we don't think about, that we're careless about. Is there a place in the model for shame, fear, you know, of letting down my parent or doing the wrong thing or being scared of the consequence?
Yes. So I think that there's some nuance here between shame and guilt. Mm-hmm. And so I think that if we just say that shame is a reflection on who we are, it's a description of our character, like in a failure of our character and mm-hmm. who we are, I think that is why Brené Brown would say, let's get rid of that, right? Because this isn't about our character. This is about our decision-making. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, feel guilty that you made that decision that hurt someone else's feelings, right? Feel fear that you're going to be thrown in jail if you make a decision like that. But the reality is, not everyone in prison is evil.
Mm, of course.
Right? Most people, I would argue, have made really poor decisions.
Yeah, I'm with you on that.
Right. So then, great. Make a poor decision like that, right? And hopefully, seeing that happens when you make a poor decision, like robbing a store because you're broke, that it would deter you from doing that out of fear that could happen. But I don't think that you need to feel shame every time you make a poor decision. Because it's not about, doesn't mean you're a bad person because you made a poor decision.
Yeah.
It means you made a poor decision.
Yeah. Yeah. Which I think is the really important distinction. So I'm glad you're really focused in on that. With this prison theme that keeps popping up.
I don't know where this comes from.
No, I know. It's triggering these thoughts of these questions in my brain, which I'm like, I wonder what the answer to that is, which is like, is there a disproportionate representation of people in the prison system with ADHD, like, and with behavioral issues or learning difficulties that come from the way that their brain is wired?
Yeah, so I actually don't know. I don't know the population breakdown. I have seen some research that shows that teens with ADHD have a higher likelihood of committing crimes, which makes sense because you don't have the impulse control that you have when you don't have ADHD and you have some instant gratification issues. And so there is some poor decision making. And then there is, you know, something that we know cognitively about ADHD is there's a deficit in working memory. And when you have a deficit in working memory, then you can't hold all of the variables in mind at the exact same time in order to act on them. Mm-hmm. And so the potential consequences of one's decision is, you know, a group of variables, right? That you're not able to hold in mind while you're trying to decide, do I make this bad decision or not? And so it makes sense, right? That particularly adolescents and teens with ADHD do find themselves experiencing some criminality because of it's poor decision making, right? It's poor reasoning skills, the low working memory. Like I said, I don't want to guess at the actual breakdown, but I would believe it simply because I think that we haven't supported adolescents and teens with ADHD as best that we should or can historically. And so maybe we are finding some overrepresentation. Sure.
Yeah. On that conversation, I guess, before people get to prison or, you know, in the early stages of needing help. And I've got a few friends that have ADHD and, you know, it feels like we're in this real boom of ADHD. And we've talked about that on our previous episode, is that, you know, does everybody have ADHD? But I'm curious, when it comes to going to therapy or personal development stuff, what kind of people or what kind of conversations or traits do people have where they go to therapy for a long time trying to fix themselves only to later discover I have ADHD and now everything finally makes sense?
Yeah. I mean, there is this aha moment that happens when you get a late diagnosis where you feel this extreme sense of relief that, oh, that totally explains now why I was unable to regulate my emotions, right? Mm. So rejection sensitive dysphoria and emotion dysregulation is a huge piece of ADHD. It's not a diagnostic criteria, which is crazy to me because we see it in most people with ADHD, is that emotion dysregulation piece. And the reality is talk therapy does not regulate our emotions. And so until we learn emotion regulation strategies, like the neurobiology of what it looks like to vibrate our vagus nerve or do some grounding exercises or breathing exercises or even using a vagus nerve stimulator or, right? All of the ways that we can learn how to regulate our nervous system, then all the talk therapy in the world, right, is just that, right? Mm. Okay, you can help me talk through my poor decisions and you can help me talk through, you know, the problems that I'm feeling, but I cannot regulate my emotions through talking. Because when we're in fight or flight, we can't even process language effectively. So like, where's the logic there? Well, let's talk about it.
Yeah, I say some pretty stupid stuff when I'm fired up.
I mean, like, you need an ice pack on your face to activate the mammalian dive reflex, to activate the parasympathetic nervous system, to calm your Hulk brain.
Right? Yeah. Like,
so talking about it in that moment is not going to help.
Well, and maybe this ties into that whole why so many people are estranged from their parents, you know, is that all they've done, or maybe not all they've done, I'm generalizing in my comments, obviously, but all they've done is sit down and talk about the problem, focus on the problem, which just is, and this is why I ended up getting into the work that I do with emotional binge and overeating, is because, yeah, we're using things to cope with or run away from our actual feelings. And talking about the problem, like you said, still doesn't get us into our feelings. And I really believe in the idea that the feeling is the healing, but so many people are resistant to sitting in that mud of like the anger or, you know, the sadness or the depression or, you know, and our culture as well is sort of very head focused, think, logical solutions. So I guess that leads me to ask, like, how do you invite people to start introducing practices that allow them to feel their body and let their nervous system deal with it and regulate it and release it?
Yeah. So if we ask people to feel their feelings without giving them the tools to manage that, then that's what makes it terrifying and scary, because then you're feeling these big feelings with no way out.
Yeah.
And so we have to be in that space with our child's big feelings or our partner's big feelings or our client's big feelings. And they have to know that we're not afraid of those big feelings, that it's not going to rattle us, that nothing that they're feeling is going to scare us. We have to co-regulate, right? Because emotions are contagious because of our mirror neurons. So we can't allow ourselves to get dysregulated. But when we model calm, right, like then that creates the safe space for who we're working with. But we have to be able to say, hey, I notice that you're struggling in this moment. Can I help? Let's just take a deep breath in and then we're going to do a really slow exhale together, right? Or, hey, like I notice that you're having a hard time calming down right now. Can I walk through an exercise with you? Let's look around and can you name 5 things that you can see and then 4 things you can hear and do like sensory grounding, right? Like So if we give them the tools then that they can walk out of our office or our room or wherever we are and use them themselves, then emotions don't feel so scary, right? Oh, I notice that I'm feeling this and I have the tools to do something with it, right? And then I can work through what it was that I was feeling. But as long as it's just continuing to dysregulate our nervous system, then having feelings and sitting in our feelings is not going to move us forward.
Mm. Yeah.
If it's terrifying us, right?
Yeah. Well, and I guess most of us are in families or have been raised by people that equally didn't know. And so we've got this snowball effect of, I don't know how to manage my emotions. And so when you have emotions, I'm a mess as well. And everybody's a mess.
Stop
and everyone's
crying. Stop crying. Why are you crying? Yeah.
You're triggering me.
Exactly. Right.
Yeah, so it's like it's just been this snowball. I wonder if we've ever had those skills in human history or whether it's just been, you know, a select few, or maybe this is the first time we're really getting our hands on it, you know, and really understanding it. Because we often romanticize the past when it comes to natural and holistic health. But I'm curious, did we always have this challenge? I'm not sure if there's an answer to that, maybe.
Well, I think that, you know, I don't know about in Australia, but you know, earlier American society was very proper, right? Mm. So we were not going to show our feelings in public, right? So we dealt with our feelings societally in private.
Yeah.
And so then when you know that there is no room for feelings publicly, then you stuff them down and stuff them down, stuff them down. And then they're going to come out some other way.
Oh, right. Totally.
So they're going to come out in your communication skills. They're going to come out in your health, right? Perhaps it's why our lifespan was so short before we were able to actually talk about feelings. That just popped into my
mind. I love what's popping into your brain. But Chinese medicine has been talking for thousands of years about the way that different emotions, unprocessed emotions or traumas, affect different organs in the body. Like that's, and Ayurveda as well, the Indian medicine that's been around for thousands of years too. So those ideas have definitely been with us for a long time. But Australian culture is, everybody thinks of the Australian as, you know, relaxed and easygoing. And in a way over here, it feels like if you're not that, you're a problem, you're an inconvenience. So Yali, who I mentioned, she's Sri Lankan. She actually was born and raised in France. And she finds it very interesting in Australia how you can't like complain about if somebody got the order wrong for dinner. It would be normal, or the bill, reviewing the bill or the invoice and being like, nah, there's a problem here. You've charged us extra for it. In Australia, nobody will really bring attention to that. They'll just try and whisper it, or they'll just pay it and be like, oh, well, you know. Whereas in France, it's like, it's normal to create a bit of a scene and whatever.
And nobody's not happy.
Yeah, nobody's affected by it because it's just normal culture, you know? And I noticed that when I've been in Italy and in multiple places in Europe, it's just normal to express a frustration or a disappointment. But definitely in Australia, we are, you're not the easygoing Australian, you're embarrassing and inconvenient.
Well, I think that was probably how our culture was 50 years ago in the United States, but it is not that way now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad these, I guess, people like you and we're having these conversations about getting these emotions out, because I think, yeah, there's a lot to heal, a lot to, you know, help people recover from. And I guess, you know, to come kind of full circle in a way, to build resilience in people, because often our breakdowns, you know, in theory should lead to breakthroughs, or our breakdowns are caused by an inability to process what's actually happening. And so I think increasing that capacity and not just talking about it and cutting off all our connections to everybody that once mattered is maybe not the solution.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And, you know, I always draw this bucket, this picture, if I have it on my desk or not. Anyway, oh, I do. Look at this. Okay, so I always kind of sketch this bucket with a rock in the center. And that rock is your trauma or what you're struggling with, or, you know, what's happening in your life that, you know, you're having a hard time dealing with. And the bucket is your capacity for dealing with it. Mm-hmm. Well, the reality is we cannot change the fact that you've experienced this trauma. We cannot change the fact that you have this stressor that cannot be changed. But what we can do is increase the size of your bucket so that stressor or trauma or tough situation takes up less space in your bucket, right? So that it isn't taking over your entire life. And so we do that by what? Identifying those things that bring you joy so that you can experience more of them, you know, where we give you nervous system regulation skills. I mean, all of the things that help build resilience so that you can increase that size of your bucket so that all of these things that are not changeable that you don't have control over, just don't take up so much space. And so I think we have to be intentional about that too, because, you know, we're in this season where, you know, we're constantly talking about, well, you know, that's a trauma response, or, well, I have trauma, so that's why I'm acting this way. Okay. But there's ways that we can help you be more resilient to what you've experienced or are experiencing.
Yeah. And I'm sure if we follow that person's life to their deathbed, they're not going to say, I'm so glad that I lived in a trauma response or used that as an excuse for my behavior for the last 75 years. Right.
Right. Right. Right. You want them to say, I lived a good life despite having some hardships along the way.
Yeah, absolutely. And you would hope too that the resilience that one earned from going through all of that made their life a much more pleasurable experience to live in, you know, just day to day. So because you're such a fascinating and amazing person to talk to, and everybody wishes they were on this podcast with us, where can everybody find you online?
So I have a podcast myself, which you have been a guest on twice.
Thank you.
We should put a link to those episodes in your show notes too.
Yeah.
So people can hear more from you. So my podcast is The Brainy Moms. And so the website is thebrainymoms.com, but we're on all podcasting platforms and on social media at The Brainy Moms. And my website is amymoorephd.com.
Fantastic. We'll put those links down in the show notes below. So if you're listening and you love Amy and you want some more, which who wouldn't, scroll down, click the button, and get into Amy's world. And before we finish, I know I've asked you this question before, but it's like more than 200 episodes ago, so maybe there's some new information. But what is one piece of health information that you wish more people knew about?
Yeah, I think that I'll circle back to where we started this entire conversation and just say that we don't have to think in black and white when we're looking for solutions for our kids when they're struggling. And that when we look at mental health struggles and neurodevelopmental disorders and ADHD and autism and dyslexia, there are lots of things that we can do to help support the brain. And nutrition would be a great place to start.
I'll second that. Amy, thanks so much for hanging out with me and just going wherever my brain went today. So thank you for that.
Thank you for having me again, Maddie. You should come back on the Brainy Moms too.
I would love that. Let's organize
it. All right. Yeah, let's do it.
All right, we'll chat soon.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye.
Hey, thanks for listening to the show. If you enjoyed this episode or learned anything at all, the gift of your 5-star rating would be incredibly helpful. And what's even more powerful is if you write a review. You can do it below each episode on Spotify, every time an episode comes out, and inside Apple Podcast, simply find the main page of this show with all the episodes on it, scroll to the bottom, hit write a review, share your amazing feedback, and then hit send. It helps this show grow tremendously and allows me to successfully invite bigger and more famous guests each time we do the show. Thank you, thank you, thank you for helping us climb the charts, climb the algorithm, and help more people. Oh, and by the way, I have a short disclaimer as well. I just wanted to quickly remind you that the information provided on this podcast is for general informational purposes only. While we strive to bring you accurate and up-to-date content, it's important to note that a lot of this is mixed with opinions, stories, and ideas not supported by mainstream science or medicine. Any advice or suggestions should not be considered a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always consult a healthcare provider before making any decisions about the health and wellness of you and your family. Remember too that what works for one person may not work for another. And just as we promote on the show, each person is responsible for their own health decisions. Thank you for tuning into the How to Not Get Sick and Die podcast. And now, the next episode. Here it is.